Hey, everybody, this is Sunny. If you were listening, you were listening on the free feed, iTunes and Google Play and the rest. You should go sign up for the Patreon at subbeacon.com because we have a very special bonus episode. That's right. We're talking about Wild Things. The Wild Things episode went up on Monday. Great response to it. Needless to say, the idea of Vic Mattis talking about the 1990s classic Wild Things with Neve Campbell and Denise Richards, big hit. So anyway, that's going to be on the Patreon forever. You'll never hear it here. It's very cheap. It's as little as $1 a month. Keeps Vic in lobster, bisques and the like, and make sure he gets lots of gout. Go sign up there. On this week's episode here, the episode you're about to listen to, we had J-Pod on to talk about House of Gucci, John Pod Hortz of Commentary Mag and other venues. Very exciting, very fun times. And this week on the episode that's going to be going live on the Patreon, we're talking about The Harder They Fall, which is a kind of fun neo-western on Netflix that I think people will enjoy watching. So check that out. Listen to the show, and we'll see you over at the Patreon. Okay, subbeacon.com. See you there.
Gucci. It was a name that sounded so sweet, so seductive.
Come, meet the family.
Hey everybody, this is Patricia.
And this is my family.
Kick these teeth out!
They had it all. Wealth, style, power. Who wouldn't care for that?
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Subbeacon. I'm Victor Mattis, along with Sonny Bunch, and in for Jonathan V. Last is our good friend, the editor of commentary, John Pod Hortz. Just a reminder, the Subbeacon is now available through Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com, you'll easily find us. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and don't forget about the Subbeacon merchandise store at tpublic.com. The holidays are upon us. Hanukkah is happening right now. Speaking of which, John, welcome back to the show.
Happy Hanukkah. Thank you. Are you making some kind of a insinuation as to my faith tradition?
Yes. Your heritage. Your heritage.
Well, you know, as I could mention, you know, my good friend Father McClanahan, with Jonathan out.
Yes.
Like Jonathan is, you know, apparently socializes solely and exclusively with men, you two, and then men of the cloth who look exactly like him.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
This is apparently the very strange doppelganger effect.
It's the sliding doors version of JVL.
It's the eyes. Yes. It's the eyes.
So, Jonathan sent me a text one day, and he said, okay, just are you sitting down? And I said yes. And then he sends me this picture, and I said to him, what are you doing in a clerical collar? And he said, it's not me, it's some priest, but it looks exactly like me.
It's uncanny. It's like when people think that I'm Shang-Chi when I walk down the street because we share similar body types.
Wait, are you Shang-Chi or Benedict Wong? You were good last. No, but you said you were Benedict Wong last week.
That's right. I have his neck.
Apparently,
size.
To you,
I have his neck size.
Apparently, to you, you all look alike.
I get confused myself. Okay.
JBL grew a goatee, yeah, would that make him the evil priest? Would make him like, yes, the mirror universe priest?
Yes. Oh, you mean, yes, like the Spock priest?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, yeah, that's an interesting. Now, I told him that I had a doppelganger, and it was a very, very weird experience in 1993 when I was the TV critic of the New York Post. I went to the TV critics press tour, which is a 3-week gathering then of like all the TV critics in the country would go, and they would stay at the Universal Sheraton Hotel in LA, and the television networks would peddle their wares for the fall and give people a chance to meet and greet with creators and actors and, you know, try to seduce us into saying nice things about their show. So there were about 80 or 90 of us then in the good old days,
yeah,
when there were newspaper critics. Yeah. And I showed up and then I went to things. People were like, "Hey, Phil. Phil, how you doing, Phil? What's going on, Phil?" And I'm like, I'm Phil? What are you talking about?" And there was a critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, who is now then went to the Chicago Tribune and then took a buyout. And I don't know what he's doing now. And if you looked him up, you wouldn't see this then. You wouldn't see it now, because we looked astonishingly like his name was Phil Rosenthal, not the Phil Rosenthal who made Everybody Loves Raymond, but
sure.
Phil Rosenthal, the TV critic then of the Chicago Sun-Times.
Wow.
And I was the critic of the New York Post, so that's, you know, first city, second city. And we did indeed look very much alike, and it was extremely disturbing.
Did you meet him in person at this?
I did. Met him. We hung out together. It was really strange. As I say, whatever commonality we had then vanished. Like I haven't seen him in 25 years. But
I hope you didn't touch him, because that's the rule, right? If you touch him, then matter
and antimatter. Oh, you're saying that like crossing the streams?
Yes, and then something
or
terrible
like
happens.
Cop.
Time cop. That's what I was going to say.
It's is that time cop? If you touch, what happens? Then you become the other person.
There's something terrible.
I think the universe explodes.
I never saw time cop.
Oh, you can.
I don't think you're missing
that
much.
Time cop. It's all you need to see is that scene. They push him into the other guy. And then like, and then, you know, something horrible happens. Well, good. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. Do you guys think that outside of Back to the Future, that there is actually a defensible time travel movie?
Well, Tenet. You're forgetting Tenet already.
Speak very funny.
Yeah, Tenet is the best time travel movie because it affords people the power to make bullets go back into a gun.
Into the
jump
barrel.
Back into the gun. Entropy.
It's very useful.
So that is...
Just feel it. Don't try and think your way through it. Just feel it.
That is not entropy.
It's not what entropy means.
It's not time going backwards. Anyway.
It's going to be 15 minutes later. We're still be talking
about
Tenet.
Donnie Darko.
Aside from Tenet.
I have one.
Is there a defensible time travel movie?
Yes. The movie that had to change its name for some reason, and it was originally, I think, Time After Time, and it became The Time Machine, or was it The Time Machine, and it became the one with H.G. Wells and Jack the Ripper?
No, that's Time After Time.
Yes, and Mary Steenburgen.
Right.
I love that movie. Did you like that movie, John?
But I it's great. It's fantastic. So H.G. Wells, in fact, constructs a time machine. And Jack the Ripper, who is one of his friends, who I think is played by Christopher Plummer or David Warner, comes. They both end up in contemporary San Francisco, and Wells falls in love with Mary Steenburgen, as in fact Malcolm McDowell fell in love with Mary Steenburgen in real life, and they got married, and they had kids, and they got divorced. And Jack the Ripper starts being Jack the Ripper in San Francisco, in 1980. And they have this great confrontation scene where Jack the Ripper says, "I belong here. This actually is kind of like this is what
now?
This is what I in London in 1890, like no one was getting killed like this, but here it happens all the time. Like I don't know what you're worried about. This is my milieu,
which was San Francisco in the late 70s.
Yeah."
Yeah, which is nothing like today, obviously. Phew.
No, thank goodness. There is a book by David Talbot, a person I don't like. I generally speaking, thought very little of the founder of Salon, but he wrote a book that's a history of San Francisco. The title, it's called Season of the Witch, which is a history of San Francisco, and it's actually really good, and it is worth reading because it reminds you of how psychotic America in the 1970s was. And what was going on in San Francisco from like 1967, really until Jim Jones's People's Temple, hide off to Guyana and then everybody killed themselves. What happened in those 10 years was a kind of social politicized social barbarity that is almost unthinkable, and that somehow it just happened like in real time.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading David Frum's book on the 1970s a few years back, maybe 5 years ago, and just thinking like, oh, this all sounds terrible. This is just the worst place on earth. It's amazing. I
grew up in New York in the 1970s, and I'm saying like San Francisco, New York was like a paragon of good common sense and social stability compared to San Francisco, where, Black Panthers were killing each other, and then people were going around and hunting white people. Black criminals were going around hunting white people for sport. Mm-hmm. Hippies invented their own kind of script. They created a currency that you could use in the hate to buy free medicines. And then, of course, all the junkies came and stole all the medicine. And then, of course, Harvey Milk was killed by the crazy
the Twinkie defense.
Two city councilmen, you know, one city councilman kills another city councilman, and the mayor of the city is assassinated by the same guy. And then, of course, comes the People's Temple, which was like this very politically very important. Considered the People's Temple, Jim Jones's temple, got George Moscone, the guy who was killed, elected mayor. They are given credit by almost everyone for being the get-out-the-vote machine that got George Moscone elected mayor of San Francisco, the guy who got assassinated by Dan White. That's how important and powerful they were. And then they go to Jonestown, and then 900 people commit suicide drinking the Kool-Aid. That was one city. Oh, Patty Hearst.
Oh yeah,
another one. Patty Hearst kidnapped in San Francisco.
Yeah, SLA.
SLA. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Wow. And the Zodiac Killer.
And the Zodiac.
Haven't even talked about the Zodiac.
I mean, this all happened in one, and it's a relatively small city. You know, it's like 500,000 people. It's not, you know, I mean, and it was like just something got loose. You know, like everything got loose, and of course AIDS also, of course, was basically incubated and generated in San Francisco.
John, one of the things is just moving slightly off of the craziness of San Francisco. One of the reasons I was excited to have you on today was to talk about Stephen Sondheim, because I'm not a musical theater person.
No, you don't like musicals.
You're not.
I don't have really what your favorite Harold Arlen show was. Formed thoughts on Stephen Sondheim. So I'm hoping you can make the case for Stephen Sondheim to me, a Philistine in the world of musical theater.
Well, so next week, West Side Story opens. This new version of West Side Story opens.
Right.
It's 2021, right? The end of 2021. Sondheim wrote the lyrics to West Side Story in 1957 when he was 25 years old.
Wow. So 54 years ago.
64 years ago. So he was 25 years old. He wrote the lyrics to West Side Story, which include some of the greatest American songs. Second show is a show called Gypsy, which many people consider the best musical ever done, with a score by Jewel Stein. He had studied music composition at Williams College, had already written the music and lyrics to a show that didn't get produced, thought he was going to be a composer and lyricist, but took these two jobs as a lyricist on these two enduring shows that are, in fact, the biggest hits he would ever be involved with, or the biggest classics he would ever be involved with. And then he wrote his own show, which was also a huge hit. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, this burlesque Roman farce. Then he wrote a flop called Anyone Can Whistle. And then 5 years after, then he wrote a show with Richard Rodgers, which was a flop. And then 5 years later, he revolutionized American theater. He wrote the music and lyrics to the first, was known as a concept musical. So it's not a plot, it's about marriage. It's a musical about marriage as told through the eyes of a single guy and his married couple friends, and why it is that he can't commit to marriage because he's sort of seeing them and seeing how their marriages don't work. And then he had this run of shows in the 1970s. He had Company, then he had a show called Follies, which is a sort of show about a theater that is being torn down that was once housed the great sort of like romantic theater musical spectacles of 40 years ago. It's a show about the acrid quality of nostalgia, the dangers of nostalgia, the horrors of memory. We wrote a show called Pacific Overtures, which is about American opening to Japan, or the American forcible opening of Japan's borders in the 1850s. He then wrote a show called A Little Night Music, which is a adaptation of an Ingmar Bergman movie called Smiles of a Summer Night, a kind of bittersweet romance about a man and the woman that he was once in love with. And then he wrote the greatest work of American theater, Sweeney Todd. Didn't write the books to any of these shows. Sweeney Todd is an opera. Mm-hmm. Basically, it is an opera with a deranged subject based on a Victorian melodrama about a vengeance melodrama about a wrongly imprisoned man who was transported to Australia by a judge who covets his wife, and he returns from Australia after being on a shipwreck, sets up shop as a barber, and then starts killing people, and his deranged landlady chops them up, makes them into meat pies, and sells them. Mm. So I'm describing all of these shows.
So that's actually the only one I've actually seen.
Because you saw the movie.
Because I saw the movie.
Saw the movie, okay. So what is it about him? And then he wrote, but I mean, so he had this career. He basically stopped producing shows in 2008, which is pretty late for, I mean, he was in his late 70s, and he put on a show called Bounce or Roadshow, had different names that didn't really go anywhere. And he wrote an astonishing variety of songs. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs. He was the most productive person in some ways in the history of the American theater. A 50-year career, 45-year career. The shows are often unsatisfying. The songs are insanely witty, amazingly moving at times, incredibly powerful at other times. And, you know, he. I don't know how to make the case for this without anybody having sort of familiarity with what he did, but he was a wordsmith of unbelievable facility. There are only two lyricists in American history who can even rival him. That's Cole Porter and Lorenz Hart. Mm-hmm. For sort of cleverness, wordplay, triple rhymes, interior rhymes, that kind of thing. And he wrote these amazingly powerful songs about, disappointed in the voice of a disappointed middle-aged woman full of self-loathing who does nothing with her life but go to lunch. Mm. A song called The Ladies Who Lunch. Or this astounding song from his show Pacific Overtures, which is maybe the greatest single number in American theater history, called Someone in a Tree, which tries to recount the negotiations between the Japanese and the Americans on reopening Japan from the perspective of an old man who is singing a duet with his 10-year-old self, who is in a tree watching the action from afar, which he cannot hear, because historically there is no record of what went on in this treaty house where they did this negotiation. But he is describing what happened physically as these people moved around the room. And then he has this moment in which he says, I am part of the event. If I weren't here, who's to say that what happened here would have happened here, sort of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in song. And again, it's hard to describe songs in that way.
I guess here's my question. So a lot of the people I saw eulogizing him said without him, modern Broadway doesn't exist. He revolutionized how the modern musical theater works. And I'm just curious on from your POV, like, is that true? And like, if so, what was it specifically? Was it just the quality of the songs? Was it like, you know, because you say, I mean, my takeaway from a lot of these obituaries was that the individual plays were not super successful often.
Right.
That it was.
Yes. Some of the shows weren't successful, and they have had a second or third or fourth life, like anything, like movies, you know, that we know. They are, you know, just the initial public response doesn't mean that they're right about it. You know, it's just that the show was
like, for instance, with Tenet.
Exactly. So it's like it was too ahead of its time, or it was too sour in a way that doesn't really bother people when they see it 10 years later. So the shows are often ahead of their time. I like some of them. I don't like others of them. There's never been anybody like him. The only great songwriter, the only two songwriters in American history for theater who wrote words and music and did the kind of thing that he did over the course of a career were Cole Porter and Irving Berlin. He had a longer, in some ways, I mean, he kind of had a longer career than both. He was far more innovative than either, although Irving Berlin was basically the founder of the American popular song, so it's a little hard to say that he was less innovative than Irving Berlin. But he was a boundary pusher. He never repeated himself. He was always trying to write something new and different and interesting. And the variety of songs, the hundreds and hundreds of songs, not a bad one, not just the songs that he wrote, but also the songs to which he wrote lyrics. It's like without peer and without parallel. The only last thing I'll say is that he was, and I said this on the commentary podcast, he's it. Like, American mid-century was this very self-confident, roaring, culturally confident place that was making an announcement to the world that it was now the leading power. Its fiction was more energetic. Its painting dominated everything. Its theater took over from British theater. Obviously, the cinema, you know, which was all considered the, you know, European cinema was considered far superior and far more sophisticated. That all ended, that nonsense idea that somehow American cinema was inferior to European cinema. It was a bold, self-confident enunciation of American self-confidence. And he was one of the primary figures in that assertion of American centrality in sort of the arts and culture and the American century. And his passing reminds us that, you know, with the maybe the exception of somebody like Lin-Manuel Miranda, there are no such figures anymore. Mm-hmm. There's no leading American novelists. I mean, there's no, this is kind of Ross Douthat's point in The Decadent Society. Like, we're not minting new people who are sort of like saying, hey, this is us, this is America, this is, we're sort of like, everything is smaller and shrunken and much more.
Yeah. But isn't that just that's just a function of the shattering of the monoculture, though, right? I mean, that is, as much as anything else, like, we have infinite choices and infinite avenues. I mean, look, I'm starting to make my, you know, top 10 list of the year, and half of the movies on it will probably gross less than...
I was going to say, can you get to 10?
$15 million, you know?
But, you know, that's fine. Look, you know, you think about leading writers of the 1950s, you know, when they said a book was a bestseller, you know, when The Adventures of Augie March by Saul Bellow was a bestseller, it sold 27,000 copies. Like, we're not...
Sure.
It's not that there was a monoculture and it was very possible for some people to become dominant figures in it. I'm not talking about success somehow. I'm just talking about a kind of national, like, a spirit that, even though these people were all anti-American and they didn't like, you know, they hated America and they liked Europe and all of that, they were infused with this spirit that they could do anything, they could say anything, that the world was their oyster, that these artistic forms were something that they could dominate, that they had no sense of modesty or, you know, reticence about, like, swinging for the fences. And I don't see that anywhere anymore.
A nation of Kanye Wests, is what you're saying.
Sonny, does this make you now more inclined to want to see musicals after listening to John?
No, I mean, my problem with music, I mean, look, we can talk about this more when we sure. do the West Side Story Ooh. Episode.
Are we really?
I would assume we are. Are we not? I don't sure. know. But I mean, my issue with musicals is that I simply don't understand the form. My problem is I can't hear, I've discussed this maybe on this show, certainly on Across the Movie Aisle, but I can't parse lyrics as dialogue.
Right.
I just can't do it.
I think
the story.
Need, yeah.
The story I always tell people is my wife, my lovely wife, bought me tickets to see what's the musical by the
Cats,
the Book of Mormon.
Oh, yeah.
Bought me tickets to go see the Book of Mormon, which is
everybody
like,
loves.
By the South Park guys, which is very funny, which like should be right up my alley. If I was ever going to like a musical, it would be that one. And I came out of it, and I was like, I'm bored. This
okay,
does
but wait.
For
so
me.
Forget those. Forget those as musicals. Forget stage musicals. Forget that. Like when you were a kid, like the Wizard of Oz, could you make sense out of like the Scarecrow song or the Tin Man song?
No, but those. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but those are slightly different. I mean,
Disney,
that's...
like the little. If you watch, Encanto with your kid, yeah. or you watch Moana, those are musicals.
I've always drawn a distinction between like cartoon musicals and real life musicals uh-huh. For whatever reason. Right. It doesn't affect me the same way.
Look, I totally understand the notion that there is a hump that you either get over or you don't get over when people mm-hmm. just sort of burst out into song. It is a highly problematic thing. And in some sense, unless you were inured to it or you even like it as you like the artificiality of it, it's difficult and if you never I can't read The Lord of the Rings. I have tried to read The Lord of the Rings 7 or 8 times. I tried to read it to my son recently, and when Tom Bombadil starts spouting
that's a long stretch.
I
stopped reading after Goldberry.
Okay, yeah, no, but they're like, and then they're going up a hill and they're going down a hill, and then they dined on kippers and pheasant, and then they slept in the woods, and then they got up and all this, and these are the most popular books of the 20th century by most reckonings. Fantasy, that kind of fantasy, just I see one name I was trying to watch this Wheel of Time on Amazon, and it's like, we are of the Aes Sedai, and I'm like, okay, I'm done. Like,
stop.
I can't. That is so stupid. Like, why are you using it? But tens of millions of people
Dune.
Like it.
Yeah, you love Dune.
Huh?
And yet you love Dune.
I love Dune because Dune, and I like Game of Thrones. First of all, Game of Thrones is about is about 15th century England, actually. So that's why I like Game of Thrones.
Why I like Game of Thrones? Why I like Game of Thrones? Because of the story.
Amelia Clark?
The
because
story.
Of the story.
The
you
plot.
Like it.
Because
it's
of the
like,
plot.
It's, yeah, no, you like
you watch
the plot.
I
like
it
for the
music.
You like the plot, yeah. Yeah. No, but I like stories of palace intrigue, and Dune is... Dune doesn't have the, and then when they have to go find the blar blar in the,
no,
there's something
it moves
about
along
the,
very well.
The
it
ridiculous words well. Of fantasy that totally
Sardaukar.
Take me out of it.
Yeah.
And then
Shai Halu.
Well, and then they
no,
have
those,
well, and then they
I'm
have
sorry,
the subtitles. They have subtitles, which I appreciate.
The genius of Frank Herbert, and I mean this honestly, is he wasn't making up gibberish. He was using essentially Islamic and Hebrew
That's right.
words and things that were familiar to the human ear, whereas all
yes.
fantasy
well,
sounds like
but,
a
no,
town
but,
in
J.R.R. Tolkien. J.R.R. Tolkien is literally a linguist. He was. Sure. I mean, he was. He
I
was
am aware of that.
Stuff from old ye old English. And
yeah,
the,
well,
and
I
the
don't
sort.
Speak ye olde English, and no one does. But I mean, I'm not. I'm just saying that I appreciate your difficulty with musicals. I have the same difficulty with fantasy.
That's understandable.
Sonny, what I think you needed to have happen to you in your life is you needed to have gone to a good musical with great and catchy songs with a good actor. This happened to me many years ago when I went to Broadway and I saw Guys and Dolls with the legendary Broadway performer Jamie Farr.
That is beautiful. Jamie Farr. Do you know that I have an autographed copy of Jamie Farr's autobiography?
I didn't know he had an autobiography, which is called
Just Farr Fun.
It's a kind of a title I would have come up with.
It doesn't even make sense.
Just no, Farr Fun. I don't.
Oh, Just Farr. Oh, yeah. Just Farr. Oh, my God. Yes, fun. That's the worst thing I've ever.
I don't like signed books. Like, you know, I've known writers all my life, and people are always signing each other's books, and I kind of don't like, it's considered like a great honor, and whatever. It's a weird thing. I don't like, but if I get a trashola showbiz book signed by somebody, my wife got Barry Williams to sign Growing Up Brady.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
That book holds a treasured place in our family library.
I hope that's right next to Just Farr Fun. I hope that Jamie Farr talks about his experience playing a sheik in Cannonball Run, which is because his background, what is his ethnicity?
He's Lebanese, I think.
He's Lebanese, yeah. I think he's Lebanese.
Like Casey Kasem.
Yes, like Casey Kasem. And Hank Azaria. No, Hank Azaria is Syrian.
Hank Azaria is a Syrian Jew. Casey Kasem would have liked to kill Hank Azaria before his family or his ex-wife killed him. We don't know who killed him.
Yes, that's a fantastic end of life.
You don't want to end up like Casey Kasem.
He kept his feet on the ground and the rest of his body. Sorry. You mentioned
his body under the ground.
Under the ground. That's right. Now, it's so funny. It's interesting, John, you mentioned Encanto, because guess what? Over the weekend, it was at the top of the box office with $27.2 million, followed by Ghostbusters Afterlife with $24.5 million. And in third place, House of Gucci with $14.4 million. Do you guys have box office thoughts?
I have a box office thought, which is that Ghostbusters Afterlife has held very well and will probably end up grossing more than the 2016 version. But what I do find very interesting is still just kind of how soft the box office is. I mean, Encanto is a family movie. In theory, this should be a big Thanksgiving season hit. People should be going to see this, and nobody's interested. Now, maybe that just has to do with the fact that Encanto's like not. I hear very mediocre things. I haven't even gone to see it yet. I didn't know about this movie
until I saw the trailer.
Yeah, but it's the whole box office remains soft. I mean, House of Gucci did, you know, $20 million over the 5 days, which is twice as much money as The Last Duel made, which. Also
same director,
by Ridley Scott. Yeah, so yeah. You know that in theory that's a good sign. Same but director. Everything remains just very very soft. But I was texting with John about this. The Ghostbusters Afterlife, the family friendly hit of the winter season. People love it. It held well.
Yeah,
I think it'll keep going.
Yeah, because people are stupid. Because it's terrible.
It's so good. It's so good.
You know what?
John.
Just give me the last 30 minutes.
Can I share with you the following observation I made like 2 weeks after seeing it? It's like L'Esprit de Scalier. Like, I finally saw everything that was wrong with the movie in this one thought.
Okay.
So, of course, according to Ghostbusters Afterlife, the events of Ghostbusters happened, right? They were 30 years or 40 years in the past, and they happened. Though the fact that they proved the existence of the supernatural seems not to have affected anybody in any way, shape, or form.
No cell phones back then.
Yeah.
No,
but I mean, the supernatural was proven to exist in the universe in which Ghostbusters is. And everybody, and Phoebe, the heroine, says, I don't believe in ghosts, which...
I'm sorry. In Ghostbusters 2, yes. Literally just 5 years later, after a giant marshmallow man was walking around downtown Manhattan, the people of New York were like, we don't believe in ghosts.
No.
These Ghostbusters are fakes.
The Ghostbusters were, this is a great conservative point, the Ghostbusters were driven into poverty by lawsuits, by unjust tort action against them after they saved the city. And the city is bad because it was being possessed by ill feelings from the river of slime in the subway. Anyway, I don't want to defend this. Here's the only thing I wanted to say was this. there's a moment, the big product placement moment in Ghostbusters Afterlife is Paul Rudd is in the supermarket and he's or Walmart and he's buying marshmallows and they're like little Stay Puffed marshmallow men that dance out of a package and yes. they all sort of come to life. Adorable. And this, by the way, is another thing which is utterly stolen from Gremlins 2. The yes. whole bit is like Joe Dante or whoever it is that made Gremlins 2 should yes. sue because the scene is an act of utter plagiarism. All they're doing is what the Gremlins 2, by the way, is one of the best overlooked movies ever made. Wild, crazy comedy about
you know, I didn't see the sequel.
Oh my God, Vic, this is an actual assignment for you to watch with your kids. It is Gremlins fantastic.
I liked the first one. It is so much better than the first. Was that Chris Columbus? It might have been Chris.
No. It's Joe Dante. Anyway, it's fantastic and bizarre and crazy and like a wild Bugs Bunny like cartoon movie. Anyway, so the Stay Puffed company, according to Ghostbusters Afterlife, is still in business. Who on earth is going to buy Stay Puffed marshmallows they manifested? I told you this, Sonny.
I disagree with you on this. You cannot buy that sort of product placement. You cannot buy that sort of brand
awareness.
No one
has named Adolf. No one has been named Adolf in 75 years.
But the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man was much happier than Adolf Hitler. He had that big grin on his face, even as he was accidentally stepping on cars and churches and people. You know, people love that guy. People love that little guy. Big guy.
All right. So, okay. Well, I don't know why we're going on with this, except it's so bad and people are going to see it.
But that is not the movie we're talking about. Okay. Although we basically did talk about it.
Okay.
This episode, well as other movies. We talked about many movies in this episode, but the main movie, believe it or not, going 36 minutes into the show, House of Gucci by Ridley Scott. Yeah. John, as our guest co-host, would you like to give a big boy review?
House of Gucci tells the story of the doomed relationship between Maurizio Gucci, the diffident son of one of the two brothers that run the Gucci fashion house, one who lives in Milan, played by Jeremy Irons, his father, Adam Driver's playing Maurizio, his father, and the other, Al Pacino, his uncle, who lives in New York and has a son named Paolo, who also lives in Milan, played by Jared Leto, under about 250 pounds of makeup. And Maurizio, at a party, runs into the up-for-any-fun wildcat, Patrizia Reggiano, played by Lady Gaga, and she sets her cap for him and kind of gets this diffident law student in an open field tackle and seduces him, and they fall in love and become a couple. His father disowns him. He finds the first happiness he's ever had in his life working for her father's trucking company. But Patrizia did not marry Maurizio to end up spending her life in her father's trucking company, and engineers an entente between him and his uncle, Al Pacino, who decides to bring Maurizio back into the fold and try to stage some kind of a reconciliation with his father. Maurizio ends up becoming a power at Gucci. And at this point in the movie, let's say we're about 45 minutes in, and up to this point, it's a gas, in my opinion. It is a lot of fun. It's lively. It's like an old-time trashy melodrama about rich people who behave in whatever way they want to and have lavish parties and wear great clothing, and there's good music on the soundtrack, and they're discoing, and they're having sex against walls. And it's like you haven't seen a movie like this since Dallas and Dynasty kind of ended the world of the trashy big screen melodrama like 45 years ago. And then the plot kicks in, which all has to do with the intrigue over what's going to happen to the House of Gucci now that Maurizio is part of it. And at this point, and there's like 2 more hours of the movie, it falls completely apart because you cannot follow the machinations. It's based on a true story.
Yeah.
And so the story is obviously very complicated because it all involves family members suing other family members, efforts at getting control of boards or stock options or stock certificates, and lawyers double-crossing their clients or siding with new investors, and this one and that one. And throughout the whole thing, Patrizia is giving her husband very sound advice about how to be Machiavellian and take over the company that he follows. And then trouble erupts between Jared Leto, the idiot son, and Al Pacino, the kind of sybaritic father. And Al Pacino ends up in jail. And all of a sudden, for no apparent plot reason, except that this is what happened in real life, Maurizio, Adam Driver, turns on Patrizia, decides he doesn't love her anymore, throws her out of the house, and then the movie then rushes to the real life denouement, which I won't spoil. But basically you don't know where they're living. You don't know whether Maurizio and Patrizia are living in Milan or they're living in New York. They keep going back and forth, and sometimes they're visiting and sometimes he's on the board. He seems like a very diffident, like, kind of shy person. Then we're told that he spends $5 million on his wardrobe and builds it through the company, which seems completely out of character. And even the craziest aspects of the real life story, which involve a relationship between Patrizia and a TV astrologer. This is a true story, a TV astrologer lady who becomes Pina, her closest confidant,
played by Salma Hayek,
and with whom she then engineers a very destructive and crazy plot, again, of the real thing that happened. Like, they don't even get to that, or you don't really, that's the juice of it, is this like lunatic thing that happens that is absolutely like horrifying.
Yeah.
And the movie basically just sputters through its last 2 hours. And it reminds me of this fact, which is that Ridley Scott, who is now, you know, 83 years old, he just made The Last Duel, which is a fantastic movie, I think. And why? Because it has a good, solid, strong, through-line spine screenplay that makes total sense. And if you look at his history as a filmmaker, if he doesn't have a good screenplay, he thinks you can just film good scenes and kind of fix it in the editing room or find the movie in the editing room or something like that. Mm-hmm. And his movies are often terrible, beautiful, but terrible messes. And when he gets a good screenplay like Callie Curry's in Thelma and Louise or Ted Griffin's in Matchstick Men or Alan Scott's in Gladiator or Alien, which is probably his best
Alien's
movie.
Great.
He's amazing, or an amazing realizer of these visions. And when he's got a problematic screenplay like Blade Runner, he spends 35 years cutting it and recutting it and cutting it, recutting it to try to get it into the proper shape, even though Blade Runner is a visionary masterpiece of a kind, but it doesn't make any logical sense. Yes. And they had to layer over a terrible narration to deal with the fact that nobody watching it for the first time could figure out what the hell was going on. And House of Gucci is a little like that. So that's my big boy review.
Thank you, John. Sonny.
I have some thoughts on this, but first we need to get the people's opinion.
Oh, the people's opinion of this is interesting.
What did the quadrants
make?
Because I feel like this movie is a million times more complicated than Tenet.
Okay, well, no. Okay, so first of all, the general plot is a B, because it's pretty it's easy to understand. It's about power and corruption and jealousy. Okay, that's easy. There are a lot of plot holes. There are plot, like, they don't explain how they caught the criminals in the end. That was sort of rushed. Suddenly you're in court, and I'd like to see that, but that would have been another 30 minutes. Leading to my next quadrant, which is duration, that's a D. That was over 2.
How is that not an F?
You know what? It's an F would be
like... That
was like,
an F minus,
you know what?
By me.
No, like, the it was... it an F would be like Return of the King, which I believe was 17 hours long, the director's cut.
You want to know what's long is that Beatles documentary. Holy
shit. I'm still watching it.
You are?
I am, and I'm like, I can't believe I'm watching it. And then I'm like, I got to turn it off. No, and then I feel like I'm there.
It's turning me off on the Beatles. It's like I used to like the Beatles, but like, Jesus Christ, like life is too short.
Quick tangent here. I feel like Yoko. I feel like I'm sitting there with the other musicians, not really having anything to contribute, but just listening, maybe having a sandwich like she's doing. I mean, it was like really, I'm drawn in. Okay, action violence is a C. Although it's glamorous, I mean, a lot of action, the skiing, I wish I was in St. Moritz, sex, nudity, A++. That trailer scene was...
But is she...
There's no actual nudity, though.
Sex/nudity.
It's a terrible sex scene.
I think it was pretty good.
I don't agree with you.
I thought that was a throwback,
that sex scene.
It was, and there was a head between legs. When's the last time you saw that?
Broadcast TV from the mid-aughts.
Sunny and I, where are we on the quadrant?
It's nonsense.
Does not matter. Okay.
So you're saying
the overall grade is about a B-, C+, B-.
That is a very generous grade for this movie. I'm sorry.
I found myself...
The quadrants are a lie.
No, you just don't understand the quadrants, Sonny, and they speak for themselves, and you cannot question the quadrants. Also, I agree with John. I got drawn in by that opening, too. And if the only thing is, if only he didn't tell her his last name, he wouldn't have been in this thing. And he comes off, Adam Driver comes off as so... you feel like you know the guy in the beginning, and then all of a sudden it's like this other thing. Okay, Sonny, go ahead.
So here's this movie has a number of enormous problems. As John kind of gets at, the script is a mess. Whatever happened in the filming process to the script is a mess, because I was frequently confused as to literally where they were. I didn't know what country they were in. I didn't know what was going on. But, like, worse than that, there were just, like, the actual basic plot mechanics of things that were happening. Like, for instance, I don't know when the police are supposed to have discovered that the certificates weren't signed. When did all of that happen? I didn't, very basic plot points about what is actually happening in the movie did not make any sense to me. Another big problem in this movie is that it doesn't know what it wants to be. It doesn't know if it wants to be a comedy or a tragedy. It doesn't know if it wants to be over the top and ridiculous. And part of that has to do with the casting. And I have to say, I have been a Lady Gaga skeptic in terms of her acting, and I feel like I have been justified in that skepticism.
I liked her in this.
She's terrible. She's out of place compared to everybody else. She has one look, and it's this.
Sonny Bunch. But no one can see because we're on a podcast.
Her eyes just get very, very big, and that's it.
Sonny's performance was Oscar-worthy. Okay. John, go ahead.
She is dazzling, and you are bananas. The interesting thing about the movie structurally, if Scott had been competent in telling it, is that she is the innocent person. The classic sort of thing where somebody new enters an already established world, and it is through their eyes and their perspective that we learn about how that world works and what's wrong with it and why it needs to be destroyed or something like that. Like, that is the classic way you structure a movie like this. And what's interesting about this is that she is that character, but she's also the bad guy, or she's going to be a bad guy.
She's the bad guy the whole time.
But she isn't.
She manipulates and moves him into... Yes. No, I'm sorry. She comes... Rodolfo is right the whole time about
Rodolfo
her.
Is the father.
She is a money grubbing
Jeremy
snake
Irons.
Played by Jeremy Irons.
But
she is a money grubbing
gold digger
who was trying to worm her way into the family.
However, her uncle-in-law, played by Al Pacino, recognizes her as the spark plug who is going to pull. Who is going to help bring some life to this desiccated family. He's got an idiot son. Rodolfo, his brother, played by Jeremy Irons, is a sort of withdrawn, dead, death and life person. And Maurizio, played by Adam Driver, is going nowhere. He's sort of idly going to law school. He has no drive. He doesn't really know what he wants to do. I don't even know how old he is. I mean, that's the other problem this movie is. You don't know how old anybody is.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Like,
well, here's
I
the thing.
I think he's like 22, but of course Adam Driver is like pushing 40. It's like one of those things where, you know, so his way of playing young is to like fling his arms around, you know, like he doesn't have control of his arms or something. He's a very good actor and he is an extremely interesting screen presence.
Yeah, I think he's great.
You know, I still think that his performance in Marriage Story is the best American performance of the last 15 or 20 years. But you are wrong about Lady Gaga, because what I was going to say about her is that she's the bad guy. But unlike you, I found her, I hate this word, but relatable. She is the only person who is her character and the way she embodies it. She's the only person who is reacting normally to normal circumstances. She's in this family. They're sort of running the business into the ground. She has interesting ideas about how to save it. She
the
needs
knockoffs.
To manipulate.
She spotted the knockoff Gucci's.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she wants to get rid of the knockoffs, which is the only thing keeping the company afloat. And this is, all right, so this is the last big problem with the movie for me, is that it has no interest in fashion. It has absolutely no interest in like what Gucci does or what they make or how they appeal to people or what the brand means just in the world of fashion in general. And it has very little. It has a slightly more, but it still has very little interest in the actual business of fashion.
Right.
And like those are two things that could have tied this whole thing together, you know.
Imagine
Devil Wears Prada style.
Imagine a Scorsese makes a movie like this, right? I mean, it's not fair to, you know, but it's like there would have been a scene in a Scorsese version of this movie in which you would somehow have been walked through in a montage.
You would have started with the cow and wound up on the shelf in New York City.
Or you would have this explanation of how the company, which is really not very solvent, or is just basically just selling old wares in stores, is actually making tens of millions of dollars that it's hiding from the government by selling knockoffs of its own work, and therefore, on the one hand, tarnishing its brand, but on the other, like making a fortune off it, which would all be fine except for crazy reasons. Again, this is the real story. In order to keep investors from knowing that they were profiting off the knockoffs, they kept it off the books. And therefore, when a family member, and I don't really know what the real story is because it's very unclear in the movie, when a family member decides to drop a dirty dime on Al Pacino, who is profiting off this, you know, off these knockoffs, and, you know, basically get him for tax fraud. You know, it's like crazy that he did it at all. Like, you know, all he needed to do was report it to the IRS, and he would have been fine. But they were worried that it would make it would tarnish the brand. Anyway,
I was thinking, you mentioned this in your review, John, about Jared Leto, his performance. Is it so bad, or is it so bad it's good? Also, you want to talk about age problems? He's the son of Al Pacino, but he kind of looks like David Crosby. And so, I mean, it's like,
was Al
Pacino 15? What did you say, Sonny?
Well, he's a grotesque. Yeah. I mean, he's playing a grotesque. Okay. Paolo, so, I mean, Paolo is like borderline mentally retarded.
So the hilarious thing about the movie, and everybody's talked about this if you read about it, is the accents. Because all the accents are very different. Like
freewheeling.
Adam Driver is doing a very light kind of version of an Italian accent. And Lady Gaga sounds like she's from Transylvania, and Jeremy Irons sounds like Jeremy Irons, except every now and then he says, you know, grazie. And Al Pacino sounds like Al Pacino, except that he's also like, come in, we'll have some food, you know, like that. He does that, you know, like sounding like Don Cheech, like he, you know, like he picked up his accent from Don Cheech, you know, in The Godfather in the too. Sicily scene. And then there's Jared Leto. So remember, they're all speaking in accents, but theoretically they're all speaking Italian to each other, right? Because they're living in Italy. They're Italians. They're speaking Italian. Jared Leto speaks Italian as though he's speaking English. He's an Italian person who just learned English and doesn't speak English very well. So it's sort of like the, how am I supposed to, you know, he sounds like there was an actor named Vito Scotti who played like Italians on sitcoms in the 60s and 70s.
I know him. Yeah. He's great.
And then actually is an Italian in Godfather Part Two, is one of the guys, the first guy who realizes who young Don Corleone is and comes in and apologizes to him
and scrapes
and bows and all this. But, you know,
he did the landlord.
And so that's Jared Leto, who, and he has these lines of dialogue like, you are treating me like the pigeon. But he's supposedly speaking Italian.
Right.
He's the best person in this movie. He's the only one who understands.
So bad what it's movie good, is what you're saying.
And he's the only person who understands what movie he's in, which is a ridiculous movie.
Right.
And he treats the role ridiculously.
Now,
the
what's
rent
interesting
stays
about
the
yeah.
same like before.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting about that is that Ridley Scott, I think, completely agree. Ridley Scott is in love with that Jared Leto performance. Like, a normal edit of this movie would basically have probably eliminated most of Jared Leto's scenes, because they don't contribute to the through line story, which is what's going on with Maurizio and Patrizia. But there's 10 or 15 minutes of stuff between Al Pacino and Jared Leto that doesn't advance the plot, where it's like, you are my son, you are an idiot, but I love you.
When they can't find the car.
Yeah.
The best scene in the movie is when Paolo, the Jared Leto character, shows up at Rodolfo's house.
Rodolfo is
drawings.
Jeremy Irons.
He shows up with all the drawings, and he lays them out, and he flips them over one after the other. And Jeremy Irons is like, you can never show these to anyone. And at first he thinks that because they're so good, somebody will steal them. And then Jeremy Irons is like, no, because you're an idiot, and you will bring shame upon our entire house.
I think he says something to the effect of, you are like a champion of mediocrity or something to that effect.
But Jared Leto, Ridley Scott so loves Jared Leto, right, who is like 2,000% committed to this demented performance that he's giving, that he even stages, I don't know if you guys noticed, this bizarre cameo moment. There's a fashion scene at the end where the new Gucci line, under the direction of Tom Ford, the man who saved Gucci, is shown in Milan, and it's a huge triumph. And if you've seen these scenes in movies, when they do these fashion show scenes, they show backstage how there are these guys who are rushing people onto the stage. They're rushing the models onto the stage. And they're standing, no close-up, is Jared Leto himself. Jared Leto unmade up with his beard and his long hair, and he's one of the guys going, go, 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 go. Because Ridley Scott wanted to give him a cameo as himself, because Ridley Scott is in love with Jared Leto.
Ridley Scott is in love with Jared Leto.
Ridley Scott, he's got an eye for talent. Yeah.
And as I say, Jared Leto, I don't know what to make of this performance. Yeah, because it is camp. It is the campiest thing that you have ever seen. And again, this is why you're so wrong about Lady Gaga, is that she had a role that could have been camp, and she played it perfectly as a person whose every motivation you can understand, including when her heart starts breaking because Maurizio turns on her.
She felt like a spurned, and she's there begging, and he's like, you're humiliating yourself.
I was never a fan of hers, didn't like her music, found her antics nauseating. The meat suit, all the PC stuff, and all her monsters, the people she said were her fans and all that. And then she turns up in A Star Is Born, and that was a knockout performance. And in my view, this is a knockout performance. And you know why I'm right and Sonny is wrong? Because Sonny likes Tenet and I don't. and that's why I'm right about this.
No. This is all a good female performance.
Wait, you know what? I want to ask you. I really do. What is a good female performance this year? Tell me.
I thought Jodie Comer was great in The Last Duel.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Okay, but who else?
Well,
well, I don't know. I'd have to go through
my
list.
Because you don't like movies about what? Do you like?
I don't like movies about women.
This is a movie about a woman. She is the subject of this movie. Maurizio's, she is the through line of the movie. The movie mm-hmm. begins with her and it ends with her. She is the active motive force. It is, and that is.
You know who's good is Elizabeth Debicki in Tenet. That's a good performance.
A towering performance, really.
The main thing about Elizabeth Debicki is that if you need somebody for your basketball team.
I was going to say, I don't even know who she can play.
I would love her to have a love scene with Tom Cruise.
Would that be the best thing about Tenet if she was in a movie with Tom Cruise?
He'll be on stilts.
She's wearing like stilettos the entire time. She's actually 6'9"
in that
movie.
She's supposed to be Princess Diana. It's going to be very challenging unless you get
Princess Diana was tall. She was okay. Princess Diana was 5'11".
They're going to need a tall guy.
She's a very good actress. I mean, she's so good that she has actually managed to survive her height, which is, you know, there was a whole list of actresses in the 90s who only succeeded and only got big parts because Tom Cruise and Michael J. Fox were so short. This is actually true. Elizabeth Shue, Gabrielle Anwar.
Oh, Gabrielle Anwar is the same height as Herb Villechaize. Did you know that, John? It's the same height as Herb Villechaize.
Oh my God, a Julie Warner who is in Doc Hollywood, like, you know, tiny. Tom Cruise is like 5'5" or something like that, 5'6", uh-huh. and you know, mm-hmm. Michael J. Fox is, I don't know, 5'4" or something like that. So they could never hire normal height actresses.
No. That's right. The secret of my success was pushing it with Helen Slater.
Helen Slater, I think she's pretty short. Yeah, I don't know. That's right. There was actually the makeout scene with him.
Yes,
and he's got to like and he's got to look. Yes, way
that's
up.
Exactly right.
No, I mean that no, is no, no, that no. is the highly no, problematic. There, now, Alan Ladd, the great star of the 40s and 50s, was like 5'2", and they used to have to. He would literally stand on boxes in love scenes.
That's amazing.
So that because they couldn't find. Veronica Lake was the only actress short, and she was like 4'11", was like the only actress short to play
It's full of midgets, Hollywood. Before we run out of time, John, I wanted to ask you, because you said how you were drawn into that opening with the disco scene. Were you a disco guy yourself? Did you go to Studio 54?
I did not go to Studio 54, but I will tell you this, that my... I didn't have a prom. I went to a very small high school, and you know, in my class was America's foremost masturbator, Jeffrey Toobin, as you may know, who is you know off today as we're talking, you know, giving very you know stern words about the Supreme Court abortion case, having desperately tried to make his mistress get an abortion. A person of high character then as now. Anyway. Yeah. At our high school, we did not have a prom. We had just a party, and we had a dance party, and somebody went and found a disco for us to go to. Like, the idea was it was a working disco, and we could have it, like, from 8 to 11 or 8:30 to 11:30 or something like that, and come and dance. That would be ours, and then at 11:30 would open up to the general public. And so we went. It was a place called Harrod, in just south of Lincoln Center, and we went and we danced. And it was 1978, right? So it was like the height of everything, you know, Donna Summer and all this.
Oh yeah.
And then at 11:30, the regular crowd shuffles in.
Oh.
And the regular crowd is the Village People. This is a gay disco, pre-AIDS gay disco. And we're standing there, and there's a turn around, and there's like a guy in leather. There's another guy in chaps. There's a guy in an Indian headdress. You know, men are grinding into each other, and it was an eye opening. It was an eye opening experience for me. That was my key disco. The only other disco story I can tell you is I think like. 1982, 1983.
Yeah,
involved in the story. Robert Kagan, the notable intellectual giant.
Of course.
So Bob Kagan and I and our friend Joe Rose have a night out in New York, and we go to a disco called the Limelight, which is in a deconsecrated church on 6th Avenue and 21st Street. And I sensory overload. It was too noisy. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't stand the dance floor. And so I go to find the bathroom, which is like off on, you know, it's a church. So it's like I'm going through like the rectory, the naves and, you know, the alleyways and stuff like that. Yeah. And then I found the bathroom and I sort of like there's an end of the hall and there's like a guy standing like at the end of the hall. And I'm thinking, oh, he must be waiting in line for the urinal. And he feels my presence, you know, in that weird way people have when they feel like their space is being violated. And he turns to see on me. And I swear to God, like out of some ridiculous cliched movie, he is holding a mirror in his right hand and he has a rolled up dollar bill in his left nostril.
Oh, that's wild.
This actually was a real thing that I saw.
It was a real thing.
It was a real, it wasn't, this is not made up. So that's my disco.
Well, I feel
that I have interrupted you from like you didn't do your how are you and how are you and
oh no that's okay you, no
that's fine.
No,
Vic, did you run? Did you take a run? How's the gout?
Sondheim.
How's the gout?
Gout was fine. Gout was fine. Okay. I had about 10 scallops wrapped in bacon on Thanksgiving.
Is that scallops are bad for the gout?
Shellfish.
Oh, shellfish. Okay.
Shellfish is a bit much, but no. Other than that, no. We enjoyed having you.
Sonny, yes. What about you? Sonny, what about your, I need to know, like, no was time. There a problem with your
Sonny,
sun pump?
Everything
what is
fine?
It, you know?
What's going
no,
on?
has happened in my, we did have a plumbing issue. But I
see sun pump.
That's,
I said
the
there was going to be something with your sun pump. I had a feeling.
There was a plumbing thing, but we fixed it. It's all good.
And that is all the time we're giving to this episode. Again, we want to thank John Podhoretz for joining us. Also, he is the host of one of my other favorite podcasts, the Commentary Podcast. I don't know how he does it 5 days a week. By the way, John, do you notice, really quickly, I'm even interrupting my own outro, how your guests say your name with different intonations? Do you notice this every time?
I don't notice it, but it's become a like if there were audio memes, I guess it would become a meme.
It's like it's like one of them will say hi John, and then the next person will say like Noah will say hi John, and then Christine will say hi John. It's always a straight down and then up. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. Questions, comments, compliments, tweet us at SunnyBunch, at Victorina Mattis. John, you're still off Twitter?
I'm off Twitter, but I read it. I read it because I need to know when Sunny is about to express, is about to just push somebody's button.
Okay, good.
Well, it happens. I will tweet something and get. I will tweet something and get a text from John like 4 minutes later. Like, why are you saying this?
Sunny also
why
has mean replies. This? To people he doesn't know who try to put in their two cents, and he's so mean. Again, be sure to subscribe to us on Patreon, please. Don't be a cheapskate and wait 2 weeks from now. You got to hear this now. Just go to subbeacon.com. We are there. Tell your friends. Until next time.
It's funny you mentioned the me being mean to people. There was a guy today. There was a guy today. I tweeted something like hold on. Let me actually pull it up here. I tweeted people who write about culture for a living and still do not understand the difference between depiction and endorsement are utterly baffling to me. And this guy Jared Ozareko replies, I think how you depict things matters. The hero shouldn't be able to do something evil without either suffering for it or having any another sympathetic character object. And I just replied, that's completely fucking idiotic. Because it is. That's a fucking idiotic thing to tweet at me, first of all, but also just to think. Just to think in the world that, like, I need somebody in my art explaining that this bad person is bad. Where's the guy telling Hitler that he shouldn't kill all the Jews? Without that, I won't have any idea. Like, learn how to read a book, learn how to watch a movie, learn how to listen to a song, you idiot. That's how I feel all the time on Twitter.
That was, I think, a relatively civil response to what you said.
I know. I would have just hit the heart.
I mean, he was just
engaging with the thought, saying he
believes that, you know, like there should be consequences for immoral actors in art. Tolstoy thought that too. Tolstoy said that Shakespeare was bad because he didn't punish the bad characters in his really awful book, What is Art? So you, that man is Tolstoy, and you, I don't know who you are. Who are you, Sonny? Who are you, Sonny?
Well, I'm fine.
You're the man with a bone tomahawk poster behind your head.
It's a good movie.
Have you guys seen
better than anything Tolstoy ever did?
I'm sure it's fine.